Well, good afternoon, everyone. Are you cybercasting?
Yeah.
Okay, we are, this service is being cybercast. So, greetings friends around the world. I have a couple of announcements I'd like to do before I get started on the sermon. For those of you who are song leaders and speakers, I have a new schedule for the summer, for June, July, and August. And if you could just take a look at it before I print out the one I'll hand out next week, then I can correct anything that isn't going to work because of scheduling. So if we could do that. Also, everybody always wants to know who's going where for the feast. We had 87 people go ahead and express their desires for where they want to go. There's 41 to Bend, 2 to Branson, 2 to Breckenridge, 16 to Escondido, 3 to Gatlinburg, 20 to Kelowna, 5 to Lihue, 2 to Mont St. Anne, Canada, and then there were several going overseas, which I don't send in. That's you deal directly with them. So that's an idea of where people are going for the feast. It was interesting when Brett was giving his sermon, he was talking about the sun and Hezekiah's day going back 10 degrees. I ran into an interesting article on the internet, and they were talking about NASA and how NASA has all kinds of computing ability, of course, and NASA was calculating the positions of the stars and the planets, et cetera, because they don't want their probes to crash into anything that they don't know about. So they were doing all of this, and they can do it into the future, but then they also did it into the past. And it didn't work going into the past. There were some anomalies in their calculations. And they said, this can't be true. You know, this can't be this way. And finally, one of the guys in the office there said, well, you know, there's some stuff in the Bible about Joshua's long day, you know, the sun going back. So when they threw these calculations in, it all worked out. So it's amazing how if you just have some simple belief, but it works out like that. Well, getting going into the sermon here today, I'd like to ask for a show of hands. I'm going to ask a couple of questions. These are not trick questions. How many of you want to sin? How many of you want to sin? It's your desire. Okay, I don't see any hands. How many here have to repent on a regular basis? I'll raise my hand too. Okay, I think that's everyone. So we don't want to sin, but yet we do. So we have a dilemma on our hands here. We want to become more like our Savior Jesus Christ, who never sinned. The Bible tells us to become perfect, as our Father in heaven is perfect. But yet we sin, even though we don't want to. Is there a way to stop the process of sin? Is there a better way than what we've been doing to stop this process of sin? Is there a way to stop before it actually becomes sin? Now, I call it a process. Let's turn to James 1, verse 14 and 15. James 1, 14 and 15. Verse 14 says, but every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. And when lust has conceived, it brings forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. So we're all tempted We're not tempted of God. We're tempted when we're drawn away of our own lust. And then we're enticed. But this temptation starts with a thought. What if we could recognize that thought and kill that thought before we were enticed? If we recognized the thought and stopped it before it became sin. You know, we're in a mental battle. We're not in a physical battle, usually. It's a mental battle. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians 10. 2 Corinthians 10. This will be a familiar scripture. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 4. Actually, starting verse 3, sorry. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. So we're in a spiritual battle. There's a battle going on in our mind. Notice the terminology that's used here. You know, right off the bat, we're in a war. We have weapons. There are strongholds involved. Those are military terms used to talk about the battle that we're in. There are many analogies in the Bible. All different kinds of analogies. I'd like to draw an analogy today. In ancient times, there were cities. You know, we read it in Brett Sermonette, they were talking about cities being defended. But let's talk about ancient cities, how ancient cities were built, and how ancient cities were defended. And I'd like to draw an analogy in defending cities and defending ourselves in the battles that we have, defending our minds from temptation and from sin. The particular city that we're going to look at is called Megiddo. Most of us have heard of Megiddo. Megiddo was a city in the north of Judea. When Solomon became king, he set about to build the temple, and he also fortified key cities. He fortified Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. These were three key cities that were between Egypt and Israel in the south, and Mesopotamia in the north and the east. And he knew that if he could control the trade routes with these key fortified cities, that he could control the commerce and also defend the country. So he built those cities, built strong walls around them, and fortified them. Now he knew that if you were going to fortify a city, that you needed those walls, but you also needed a way to get in and out of the city. So he built gates, large gates in these cities. And he knew that he had to strengthen those gates because they were the weakest point. So how he fortified these cities and these gates will give us an idea on how to win the battle that we're up against. Now, Megiddo was built on a hill. Now, any military man will know, will, you know, understand the importance of gaining the high ground, of putting that city on a defendable position. The enemy would have to go uphill to even get to the gate. And once he got to the gate, the way Solomon designed this was there was an outer gate that you came through first. You had to walk up the road, you came to the gate, which was a gate that swung open. And on the other side of the gate, there were two chambers that you had to walk past. And these chambers could be filled with soldiers or whatever to defend that gate. But on Megiddo, if you got through the first gate, which was also plated with iron, so they couldn't just burn the gate down. But after you got through that first gate, you went into a courtyard. And the courtyard had walls around it with high towers. You went into the courtyard, and that could be easily defended from the towers. And then if you got that far and got to the main gate of the city, you turned left, went through the main gate, and on the other side of the main gate, there were six chambers. Instead of just the two chambers, there were six more chambers, so that that could be filled with men to defend that part also. And then if defenders were killed and so forth, they had trapdoors on top of the chambers, so you could lower more men down to overwhelm the enemy. So he thought this out, and this is the way Megiddo was built, so that it was very defendable. But these gates were used for other things as well. They were not just for time of war. They had other purposes. I have a little book here I'm going to read from. It's called Manners and Customs of Bible Lands by Fred Wright. And on the chapter on cities, he goes into what the gates were used for. It's the character of gates. The gates of an Oriental city were, of course, constructed with the walls. Nevertheless, they were, in a sense, a structure by themselves. They were usually made of wood or stone, or wood that had been armored with metal. The psalmist speaks of gates of brass and gates of iron. And there's scriptural references here. Often they were two-leaved and were provided with heavy locks and bars. Sometimes a city or town had two walls and therefore two gates with a space between them. A sentinel was stationed in the tower of the first gate. When David was at Mahanaim, awaiting the result of the battle with Absalom, scripture says, and David sat between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate under the wall, and lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running alone. This space between the gates was used for many purposes. And then it lists several of the purposes. The gateways of ancient walled cities and the open spaces near them were popular meeting places for the people. They seemed like large halls that could care for great assemblies of people. Being vaulted, they provided a cool place to meet on a hot day. The opening of the gates, as described in Proverbs, as the chief place of concourse, the city gate was used as a public gathering place for the giving of an address or proclamation. Concerning King Hezekiah, it was said, and he set captains of war over the people and gathered them together to him in the street of the gate of the city and spoke comfortably to them. 2 Chronicles 32:6. David speaks of his persecutors gossiping about him in the city gates. Mordecai sat in the king's gate in order to attract attention from the sovereign. That's a quote in Esther. The prophets often preached their sermons in the gates of the city. Thus the Lord told Jeremiah, go and stand in the gate of the children of the people, whereby the kings of Judah come in, and by the which they go out, in all the gates of Jerusalem. And this is a very important point here. The gates of the city were used as a place of holding court. One of the most important uses of the gates of an ancient city was for holding court. Stone seats were provided for the judges. Thus Lot sat in the gate as a judge, Genesis 19:1. The city gates of those days would be like our modern courthouse. It was there that Boaz went to redeem the estate of Elimelech and thus receive Ruth to be his wife, Ruth 4:1. The prophet Amos preached to Israel to establish judgment in the gate. The Mosaic Law recognized the city gates as the place of justice. Judges and officers shall thou make thee in all thy gates, which the Lord thy God gives you, throughout your tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. Deuteronomy 16:18. Thus it could be seen that one of the most important places in an ancient city was the gates of that city. Then it gives some references to, symbolic references to the city gates. The Bible often refers to the gates of a city in some symbolic way. Sometimes the gates are used to represent the city as a whole, as when the Lord said to Abraham, "Thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies." The psalmist was no doubt thinking of the temple gates when he said, "Open to me the gates of righteousness." And then the last thing, it's customary for the city gates to be closed at sunset. And John alludes to this by way of contrast in his description of the New Jerusalem. And that's when John in Revelation 21 said that the gates would always be open, that there would be no night. So we can see that the city gates were used for some very important purposes. Imagine if you will, that your mind is a city. What's your city like? What is your city like inside? Hopefully, our city is ruled by Jesus Christ. Hopefully, the attributes of our city are the fruits of the Spirit listed in Galatians 5:22. Hopefully, our city is full of faith and full of love. It's a peaceful city, one that has joy, attributes of long-suffering, gentleness, and goodness. Hopefully, our city is a place where God and Jesus Christ would like to live. Turn over to John 14, and verse 23. John 14, 23. Jesus answered and said unto him, "If a man love me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come unto him and make our abode with him." So hopefully, Jesus Christ and God the Father do live in our city, that our city is governed by them. The Bible makes reference to this analogy. Let's turn over to Proverbs 25. Proverbs 25 and verse 28. Mr. Sikorek read this when he was giving the sermon in Seattle here a few weeks ago. Verse 28. "He that has no rule over his own spirit, it's like a city that is broken down and without walls." So if we don't rule our city, then it's like a city without walls. See, a city in ancient Israel, like Megiddo, you couldn't, you know, not just anybody could go into that city. So if we don't rule our spirit, we just let anything in. No, and we can't do that. Let's turn to Isaiah 26, and we'll take a look at this point. Isaiah 26, verse 1. "In that day, this song shall be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Open ye the gates, that the righteous nation, which keeps the truth, may enter in. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on you, because he trusts in you." So we see that the walls that we have is salvation. Salvation will God appoint for walls and for bulwarks. notice that it talks about peace, that God will keep us in perfect peace. Let's turn to John 14 and verse 27. John 14, 27. And this our lectern from the other hall is a hire. The short guys probably like this one better. Yeah. John 14, 27. For Jesus Christ. So peace I leave with you. My peace I give unto you. Not as the world gives, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. So in our city, in our mind, we can have peace. We can have peace of mind. It's not exactly like the world gives, of course. When the world talks about peace, they're talking about the physical tranquility, usually. But we are able to have peace, even though in the world we have trouble. It's a tremendous blessing to have that peace. Now, in our city, we need judges to sit in the gates. You know, we have two main gates. We have our eyes, we have our ears. And these are strategic gates. And we need to have judges in the gate, just as an ancient city had judges who sat in that gate. And not just everyone could come in and out of that city. Let's turn to Hebrews 5 and verse 14. Hebrews 5, 14 talks about the kind of judge we should have in our gate. Verse 14, but strong meat belongs to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. We need to discern what is good and what is evil, and not allow that evil into our mind, into our city. I know a lot of this comes, you know, like it says, by reason of use. You know, it takes a little time sometimes to recognize some of the more subtle, harmful things that Satan throws at us. Let's turn to Ephesians 5 and verse 11. Ephesians 5, 11. You know, what are we allowing into our mind? Ephesians 5, 11 says, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them or expose them for what they are. You know, don't have fellowship with them. Verse 12, for it is a shame even to speak of those things which are done of them in secret. Now, if you meditate on what this says, that eliminates a big chunk of television. Now, I don't watch a lot of television, but there was a period of time of several years when I really didn't watch much TV at all. I can't remember even why right now. It's probably busy. But I thought, well, you know, I'll sit down and watch a couple of these sitcoms. And boy, what a shock. You know, to be out of it for a while and come back, and it's like, there are some of those that in this forum, I can't even tell you what the plot line is because it wouldn't be appropriate. That's how bad they get. I work in people's homes. I'm a contractor and I work in people's homes and occasionally I get what I call trapped with the soap operas on, or I get trapped. I listen to Winnie the Pooh. I listened to the Winnie the Pooh movie over and over for 2 days once. But I was working in this one house and the soap operas were on. And finally, I couldn't stand it anymore. And I told the lady, I said, where do they find this many people that are this messed up who even know each other? And she was a good sport. She said, well, I think it makes us feel better about our lives. You know, that our lives aren't that messed up, so no matter how messed up they are, they can't be that messed up, so we feel better. But there's a lot of stuff out there, and a lot of it is very subtle, that should not be allowed in our mind. Because it just, even though you know it's wrong, it still messes you up. The other main gate is our hearing. This is not a trick question either. How many of you know what the funky monkey is? Oh, come on, you do. I got trapped listening. It's a radio station out of Tacoma. I got trapped listening to that, and that is something to behold. But some us older folks. Okay, I'll Sherry's not old, but I'm getting there. Sometimes we wonder, you know, you can see sometimes a group of kids maybe walking along the street and it just looks like they're not happy. And you just wonder, well, you know, why is that? But after listening to the Funky Monkey for a few days, I've decided maybe I know why. And that's not really a put down, it's just that's what's being said then. You know, there's a group called Rage Against the Machine, and the machine basically is society, the man, and you know a lot of these songs are, well, not a lot, but a few are sort of, you know, the rage against the machine. There was one that really had it was like a little bit of insight, I guess. But it was, no matter how much I rage, I'm still just a rat in a cage. And it was like, you know, there's some truth in that. Because if you're out there in the world and you're just, and you don't know any different, it's, no matter how much you rage, you know, you're trapped. You are held captive by Satan. And the only ones who are really free are spirit-led Christians, are spirit-begotten Christians. They're the only ones who have the freedom of mind, the freedom from sin and from what's going on in the world. But the point of all this is that we really need to judge what we allow into our minds. I know through the trials in the church, I say this a lot too, you know, I know more about Protestant theology than I ever wanted to know. And I say that because even though I don't believe it, you know, I don't accept it, I think just knowing it goofs me up somehow. You know, it's in there. So we really need to guard the gates of our minds. Another thing is, I don't really remember even who came into town, but somebody came into town, guest speaker, and talked about movies. And talked about formula movies. You know, I'm not trying to go on a rant here, but I guess I am. But one of the formulas of a lot of the action movies is some villain guy comes on, does something so horrible, makes you want to hate the guy right at the beginning, And then throughout the movie, you go through all of these things, and then eventually you just want to kill the guy. And at the end, of course, he gets killed, and you're like, hooray, you know, the guy's dead. And it's like, you know, when you analyze that, you have to go, wait a minute, you know, these aren't good thoughts. So, in order to help us in our mental battle, you know, we need to watch those gates and don't let those things in. Let's turn to Romans 12 and verse 1. Romans 12, verse 1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So we need to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. We need to let the good things in and keep those bad things out. Let's turn over to Philippians. Philippians 4 and verse 6. It says, be anxious for nothing. The King James says, be careful for nothing. But in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. And the peace of God, which passes all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Jesus Christ. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true. Now he's talking about what kind of things to allow into your mind and what kind of things to think about. Because whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, things of good report. You know, it's easy to get into the trap of thinking about negative things. Not that everything, you know, is just rosy and positive, but don't dwell on the negative. But if there's any virtue, if there's any praise, think on these things. You know, let's fill our mind with the things that are worthy of our calling, these positive things. Now, Paul also said in Romans 7:23, I'm not going to turn over there, but it talked about the battle that Paul had. And he says that he delights in the law of God after the inward man. That the law of God and God's way is a delight to him. We need to keep those evil things out of our mind. I'd like to talk about when God calls us. When we're starting out in our Christian life and God calls us, you know, what kind of a state is our city in? What kind of condition is our mind in? Well, usually it's in a state of disarray. Things are, you know, we're starting to come into the knowledge of the truth. There's a lot of baggage coming along. And, you know, we're learning, we're growing, you know, in the process of conversion. And with God's help, we start cleaning house. We start throwing the bad out, letting the good in. You know, we open those gates to the Word of God and to the way of God and start throwing things out that don't belong there. We start building the walls of the city. We start fortifying the gates to defend against what we don't want in there anymore. But in this process, you know, we've talked about strongholds before. You know, Carl Anderson has talked about strongholds. and I have to a limited degree. But as we are cleaning house in the city, you know, there may be a tower in the back there that is, that turns into a stronghold. You know, it could be some resentment that we carry, some anger. You know, some time ago, I remember I was talking to a guy in the church, and he told me, he said, I am never going to forgive my father. And I mean, it just kind of took me back. It's like, well, you know, then, you know, if you're never going to forgive your father, then why are you here? You know, what you're saying is, you know, the Bible plainly says, you know, if you do not forgive, you're not going to be there. I mean, that's plain. And for somebody to say, I will never forgive, you know, well, I didn't know what to say to the guy, you know. But that's a stronghold. It's something that you haven't cleaned out of the city there. And of course, we have to surrender all of that ground in the city, in our minds. We can't leave anything in there that is going to, you know, to hinder our relationship with God in that way. So we need to surrender that piece of ground. You know, that if there's one battlement back in the back there that isn't coming around, you know, we need to surrender that piece of ground to God. You know, our entire will has to be subjugated to God's will. But what we can do, a lot of times when we have these strongholds, is we, at the city gate, we let reinforcements in. You know, even though we might not want to, you know, we will let the reinforcements in. And if we can, with our judges in the city gates, discern that, wait a minute, you know, that's a thought that is bitter, or that's a thought that is resentful or angry, you know, not let that reinforce that stronghold. And in that way, we can start to bleed the strength out of that stronghold, and with God's help, surrender that ground and get right with God by not letting those reinforcements in. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians 10 again. We were there earlier. Let's read it in this context. We don't war after the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare are not fleshly, but they're mighty through God. God is the strength here. You know, it isn't our will, but it's God's will. It's the Holy Spirit strengthening us. You know, we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. But our weapons are mighty through God to the pulling down of these strongholds, casting down imaginations. Now, those are thoughts. Casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. So we can, through God's help, take control of our thought processes, pay attention to what we're thinking and where these thoughts lead. Now what happens when our gates are attacked? What happens, like back in James 1, when we are tempted? Temptation starts with a thought. Let's turn over to Hebrews 4 and verse 15. Hebrews 4:15. Temptation is a thought. Hebrews 4:15, talking about Jesus Christ, says, "For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin." So Jesus Christ was tempted just like we are, but he did not sin. Now, I chose an example here that was harmless, I thought. Wasn't too, probably, too close to anybody, so, you know. But just to show how this would work. You know, temptation is a thought. Okay, what if you were at the gas pump, and you were at a self-service pump, and you pumped your tank full of gas, and the thought, now this happens to us, I mean, please admit this happened to me. You know, this little thought will whip through there, going, well, shoot, you know, I can just drive away. And then you go, no, I can't do that. You know, where'd that come from, you know? Get out of here. But, okay, that's a temptation, right? You know, you dismiss it. No, I'm not going to do that. That's, you know, can't do that. But, as it says in James, what if you're enticed? The thought comes in there, and then you're enticed. You say, well, you know, nobody around. No security cameras. You know, and you're enticed, and then it goes further. And you're entertaining the thought. You know, and you know, when it's conceived, it brings forth sin. You know, I mean, if you dwell on that enough, it's possible you could drive away. And that's the process. But if we could recognize that temptation, that thought, as what it is, recognize it by the discernment, you know, by the judges in your gates, and say, no. You know, that's not coming in. That's not being entertained. And if we could imagine that six-chambered gate, you know, how that thought's trying to get in. But you have six chambers worth of soldiers there to attack that thought and to get rid of that thought. Now, every military man knows that you've got to know your enemy, and you've got to plan ahead. So we know we're going to be tempted. You know, we know that. You know, if there's one thing we're sure of, it's that. So we need to plan ahead. And in planning ahead, what I would suggest is to say, okay, what are you going to do when you're tempted? You're going to pray? You know, we can pray. You can rebuke that thought. You know, I mean, this is all something that you each individually have to do. You know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to think that. I'm going to, you know, sing this song or hymn or whatever. You know, plan on what you're going to do. And one of the things that I suggest is that if you seriously have, you know, a stronghold or something that you are serious about overcoming, make yourself personally responsible to another person. I'm going to call so-and-so. And I know several years ago I gave that sermonette that was 30 years with the monkey. Remember that? Talking about a problem that I had that, one of the things, Mr. Luker was over at the house. This was in the early 80s. Mr. Licker was over at the house, and he said, and basically he made me personally responsible to him. He said, the next time this happens, call me. And I said, okay. Well, a lot of factors were involved, but I would have called him, but I've never called him. I've never had to call him, 20 years. See, that's a very powerful thing. I'm very grateful to Mr. Luker that, he did that. You know, there's a, the old story, you know, you've gone from preaching to meddling now. Well, you know, he went to meddling, and I'm glad that he did. But I think if we use this analogy, you know, to help ourselves understand the process that happens with sin, and to be aware of our thought processes, to be aware of the battle that we're all in continually against sin. You know, we don't want to sin, but yet we end up sinning because we allow these thoughts to have their work in our minds. So let's make every effort to draw close to God. Let's draw on His power in our lives to overcome sin. Sin is a heavy weight. It's the weight that drags us down in our relationship with God. It hinders our ability to have good relationships with one another. And hopefully this analogy will help us. That when we are attacked, to overwhelm the enemy with all six chambers, anything it takes, overwhelm the enemy. In closing, let's turn to Revelation 21. Revelation 21, verse 7. Says, "He that overcomes will inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son." Then he goes on talking about New Jerusalem. On the gates, you know, gates with precious stones and so forth. Verse 25 of Revelation 21. "And the gates of it shall not be shut at all by day, for there shall be no night there. And they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it. And there shall in no wise enter into it anything that defiles, neither whatsoever works abomination or makes a lie. The only thing that will be admitted are they that are written in the Lamb's Book of Life." That needs to be what our city is like. That there is nothing allowed into our city except the good things. Then in verse 14, "Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life, and they enter in through the gates into that city." So in our battle with sin, let's pull out all stops and do the very best we can with God's help to overcome sin, to live within the parameters of God's law, which is the best way to live. There isn't a better way. The only trouble we have is the trouble we have living this perfect way of life in the world. It's a straight and narrow path. But the trouble is, as it, you know, it isn't, the trouble isn't with God's way. It's living in the world we live in. So hopefully this has helped. What time is it anyway? Okay, well, we're getting out early for being good. Have a great Sabbath.